please the court with Eileen Evans for the relay.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eileen Evans. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing on behalf of the state of Texas in this proceeding, which is a mandamus matter arising out of a discovery dispute in State versus ISO et al., an antitrust enforcement action brought against various elements of the property casualty insurance industry, alleging that these defendants engaged in boycott, coercion, and intimidation in the general liability insurance market. The dispute was caused by two document discovery requests as described in our petition and relate to three categories of documents. That is, number one, materials obtained by civil investigative demand under the Texas Antitrust Act. Number two, citizen letters sent to the Attorney General's office. And number three, documents obtained or generated in connection with Attorney General duties not related to antitrust enforcement and held by divisions who operate in relation to those other AG responsibilities and duties. It is an unusual posture for the state of Texas as a plaintiff in enforcement action to be objecting to certain discovery, especially if the antitrust division, who is ordinarily in the position of arguing that materials should be turned over to us. We recognize that before this court. However, such a posture is mandated by the public policy issues that are implicated in this matter. As a policy matter, we do support broad discovery, particularly because ordinarily we are a plaintiff before the court. Furthermore, when parties resist discovery, it is frequently, although not always, because they view the information they are seeking not to disclose as being damaging to their case. It is not our view that any of the information that we seek not to disclose in any way hurts the case, state's case, notwithstanding the filing the defendants made this morning before the court.
Why don't you turn it over then? Why don't you disclose the material if it's not going to hurt you?
Because of the public policy issues that are implicated.
So you're trying to protect a public policy rather than how it's going to affect in this case?
That is precisely correct.
It is.
And the public policy issues that are related are, number one, the effective and efficient antitrust enforcement. Number two, the ability of citizens to petition their elected officials without fear of retaliation. And number three, the Attorney General's ability to effectively and efficiently his full range of statutory and constitutional duties and responsibilities.
All right, I understand number two, but how do number one and number three, if this is going to help you, if this is going to help you in the case and you just wish you could get it out, then how we're getting it out damage effective antitrust enforcement or the Attorney General's ability to fulfill his duty?
Let me address number one first, Your Honor. The antitrust enforcement, effective antitrust enforcement, requires obtaining information. It requires obtaining information from people who frequently are concerned about giving it and what the implications of providing that information might be. Now, under the Antitrust Act, when a civil investigative demand is served and information is provided, it is our construction of the law that that information is privileged and may not be disclosed except under limited circumstances, and that in fact the legislature's recognition and establishment of such a system recognizes the importance in an enforcement action of your ability to get information and then not worry about the government disclosing it. Now, the CID respondents are free to disclose their own responses, and there is no prohibition against that. In fact, there's an express permission of such disclosure. And the state has never contacted a CID respondent and said, don't provide the information, don't turn it over. And in fact, the defendants have obtained a good number of the CID questions and responses that have been provided in this case. For one thing, 75% of the CID statements were taken from them or related companies, and that is reflected in the record in Exhibit pages 7, in the 7689 hearing, pages 14 to 15 in Exhibit N.
What retaliation could be taken against an individual who simply wrote a letter to the state?
The first question is whether the individual fears retaliation and whether there's a chilling effect on a citizen feeling free to communicate to the state in connection with his or her concerns. Now,
does that policy play in with civil investigators? These people don't have a choice.
It does. It does not, Your Honor.
They have to respond.
They have to respond.
So
however,
what policy protects information that you are forced by the state to disclose?
While a witness has to respond, what a witness will reveal is limited by two things. One, whether or not they're really cooperating or whether or not they view it as truly an adversarial procedure, and whether the adversarial, the attorney in the adversarial posture asks the proper questions, as opposed to someone providing information with some sense of protection and a promise of confidentiality under the statute. That's number one.
You mean a witness may be more or less cooperative in response to CIB?
Precisely, Your Honor.
So when the witness writes back to the state and says, take your CIB and put it back on your desk, you all just say, well, okay, he's not going to be cooperative.
No, that is not the manner in which I was relating to different levels of cooperation. Perhaps I can give an example. The third civil investigative demand, a petition to set aside, is not filed. The witness appears. If they are a cooperative witness, we can essentially sit down and say, tell us what you know about this matter, and we will have a full and free disclosure of that information. If the witness is not cooperative, not in a legal sense, but in a practical, factual sense, we will have to extract each and every piece of information as you would in any adversarial deposition. And, of course, as in any deposition, whether or not a witness fails to remember, chooses to remember, and the extent to which they provide information is also a question. So clearly, cooperation is relevant in terms of CID responses, even though a response is mandatory under the statute. The fullness, the completeness, and the veracity of that response are affected by the level of cooperation.
Before you ask a question, does the state make any representation to the person being interrogated as to what might be done with that information or the confidentiality of it?
It is our usual practice to tell the witness that the information that they provide us is confidential, that we take the confidentiality provisions of the statute very seriously, but that if we need to use the information, that information may well be disclosed.
And that statement is made before the interrogation has begun?
Yes, informally and in discussion with the witness.
You indicated earlier that there was nothing in the CID materials or in the citizen letters that was adverse to the position of the state. Is that right?
There is nothing in those letters that we believe would hurt the position of the state.
Right.
That is correct.
My concern is whether anyone other than the state has ever made that determination.
Well, as to the citizen letters, the defendants have all the information except to the identifying material, that is, identifying the particular person who provided the information. So in that instance, they've had that opportunity.
The nine people that objected among the citizens, given them those letters with the names taken off?
With the names and all identifying material removed consistent with an assertion of an informant privilege.
As far as the citizen letters are concerned, that's what this battle is all about, whether you give them nine letters.
No, Your Honor.
Whether you give them the identifying material or the nine letters you've already given them, perhaps.
There are also 76 letters from persons we could not reach.
Okay.
And those are also implicated as well.
And my question, though, is whether anyone other than the state has determined that none of the material that you're withholding is harmful to the state, or put another way, would be exculpatory or beneficial to the case of your adversaries.
No, Your Honor, because while all the documents were tendered to the court for an in-camera inspection, none of the documents were inspected by the court. Now, it is our argument that under the civil investigative demand statute, the defendants had to make a showing of good cause for that production to occur, and that no showing was made. However, the documents were tendered to the court, and they were not examined.
Tendered, what, did you have them there in the, they're not part of the record before us. We don't have them, do we? We have the document logs, but we don't have the documents. We don't have the nine letters.
That's correct, Your Honor. That they were tendered to the court.
They were never made a part of the record of this case for purposes of the in-camera inspection.
That is right, because the court did not inspect them.
well, was there anything to prevent you from making them a part of the record of the case?
There is not, and if the court wishes for us to make a post-submission filing of those documents, we'll be delighted to do that.
With regard, focusing on a different aspect of your argument, with regard to your public policy arguments for secrecy of these documents, isn't it correct that under the federal CID statute, if this were being brought by the U.S. Attorney General, that the opposing counsel would be entitled to the very material that you're trying to secret?
It is correct that under the Federal Civil Process Antitrust Act, the Attorney General's Office of the United States turns over all documents that are not otherwise privileged under the Rules of Civil Procedure. Other privileges are not abrogated. Relevancy objections are not abrogated. Informant privileges are not abrogated. But as to documents that are not otherwise privileged, yes, that is absolutely correct. And the key distinction between the federal statute and the Texas statute is that the Texas statute contains a good cause provision. The federal statute does not. In fact, the federal statute is structured a little bit differently. It talks in terms of a custodian who is not the Attorney General's office, and then the custodian holds those documents and turns them over to the AG.
Let me pause right there and be sure I understand what you said so far. So under the federal statute, if you had a whistleblower within an insurance company and they contacted the Attorney General and said they're having another price fixing meeting tomorrow, that might come under the informant privilege and would be withheld. But if under a civil investigative demand, essentially a deposition was taken of an insurance executive, that would not be something that would be withheld under the federal statute.
That is my understanding, Your Honor. Although in this instance, again, I should note that 75% of the statements that were taken are from the defendants or related companies, and they have copies of those statements.
Well, those have already been provided?
Under the statute, the party from whom the statement is taken is provided a copy of their own statement.
Are there any materials that the state would plan to use at the time of trial that haven't been provided?
There are not, Your Honor. And in fact, I think it's quite clear that we would not be able to use materials at trial that we had not produced. And
why not? Why not? What prevents you from doing
it? I believe that under the Rules of Civil Procedure, a party is not going to be able to, unless they can show some extraordinary good cause, is not going to be able to use evidence or materials that has not been disclosed in connection with discovery.
If you don't have to give up the stuff that you obtained with CID procedures, why can't you use it in trial? What rule or law or case or statute prevents you from doing it?
Well, in the first instance, we have the discretion to disclose the information which we intend to use in the course of the proceeding. That's pursuant to 1510I. If we have the discretion to dispose it and we're going to use it, I would submit that in response to any discovery response to be propounded, no court is going to allow us to then proceed and use evidence that we haven't already disclosed. I also should note in that connection that and this is perhaps something that we did not make clear and should have, but in the affidavit of Mark Toby, which is part of the record in Exhibit N, Mr. Toby states that we did not use the civil investigative demand privilege or the other privileges to hide information, and further that we had fully responded in terms of persons with knowledge. The civil investigative demand names, although not designated as such, are listed as the persons with knowledge in the discovery response given. And that's also consistent, of course, with the witness statement privilege that's in 166B, which says that the existence of the witness statement privilege does not abrogate a party's responsibility to fully respond as to persons with knowledge under the rule.
I understand that the names of the people that signed the letters that have been stricken from the letters, but the names are listed on a separate list, and those names have been furnished?
I was not clear, Your Honor, in my statement. The names of the civil investigative demand respondents while not designated as such, are listed. The names of the citizens who signed the letters are not listed so as to preserve their informant status. But the letters themselves have been provided with all the information in them. And the defendants have not made a showing under the Texas Rule Civil Evidence 508, which sets forth what a party who wants to obtain informant information in the civil proceeding must do if it seeks to obtain the names of informants from the state.
What do you say could show good cause that was not done here?
If the defendants would have made a particularized showing that they were unable to proceed in this case to fairly assert their defenses, they would have been entitled to that information.
I mean, it's so hard to do when you don't want the information.
Well, I'd like to direct the court's attention specifically to a case that came out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals subsequent to the filing of the petition. That's the Texas Attorney General's Office versus Adams. And this was a case found at 793 Southwest 2nd, 771. It came out in August of this year. This is a case in which the investigative files of the State Securities Board Commissioner were at issue. And in that statute, under the statute which provides for State Securities Board investigations, the commissioner has an investigative subpoena that's much like the civil investigative demand. And the statute provides that the information is to be disclosed in the discretion of the commissioner or otherwise for good cause shown. And the court is citing to Texoma and other cases said that the good cause requirement here should be read as good cause requirement is read in other discovery statutes. And further, that arguments of counsel were not a showing and that no showing had been made to establish good cause in this case. The defendants here only made arguments. They provided no evidence whatsoever. And they have not in any way attempted to show good cause in the trial court. The precise nature of the showing they might make, I am unable to lay out for the court because I don't know what their strategy might be. But I would submit that one way to look at the good cause question could be under the substantial need cases also that have arisen under the federal rules. And the courts there are split, of course. Some say you can make general statements about timing and when information is obtained. Others say you have to make a particularized showing. Nonetheless, the defendants didn't even attempt to make any showing whatsoever, but merely relied upon argument. Similarly, before this court, they've chosen not to verify their reply under 121A2S. And our reading of the law in that instance is that if there are allegations of fact in our petition, they must then be accepted as true. That's under the authority of Nora Warehouse, Inc. versus Kelly, etc. The state brought forth affidavit testimony to turn now to Chief Justice's Phillips' earlier question about the public policy on scope of search, brought forth its affidavit testimony relating to the structure of the Attorney General's office, the fact that the state of Texas, as a party by and through the antitrust division, did not have access to the files and records of other divisions who were operating in areas other than in antitrust enforcement, and further asserted as to the affidavits from other division chiefs in related areas that a massive review of those files and records would be required.
Does this mean you're not going to look at any of those? That this case will be prepared and prosecuted without consultation with other divisions of the Attorney General's office, and no recourse would be made. Information those divisions might have.
As to information, that's correct. I wouldn't assert to the court that I might not talk about a general legal point when there was no conflict.
But I mean, it's any information that those other divisions may have found in the course of their work. That's not going to be part of what the antitrust division uses.
That's correct. The party is the state of Texas. And the defendants asserted their discovery request against all the instrumentalities and agencies of the state of Texas, including this court, and then said that they would limit it as to anything that went from those various agencies that we found in the Attorney General's office. But that limitation is not nearly enough. The difficulty with their argument is really seen if you would look at these large law firms in this case. Undoubtedly, some of the lawyers in this case and their partners have in their files the representation of other clients, information that would be of interest to the state of Texas in bringing this proceeding and might well be relevant and indeed discoverable. However, addressing a discovery request to the defendants would not result in those attorneys having to turn over that information in their files generated from other representations.
But surely, if you sent a subpoena over one of the defendants in the case and they said, well, we're going to have our antitrust office respond to this subpoena, but if people over in our securities division know something that is related to this lawsuit, they just don't have to respond. That's our position. You wouldn't think much of that position, would you?
If the state were using this to hide information, I think an argument might well be made. But that is not the case. And Your Honor, the question is whether the party, the state of Texas, is a monolith in an enforcement action. Is every agency, is every board, is every commission, is every subdivision of the state a party in that action?
It's a little less than that. It's just the AG's offices. Reduced it down to that.
They have reduced it down to what the state has in possession of the AG's office. But with the exception of the antitrust and consumer divisions, the other legal divisions, the AG's office, are in a representative capacity of state agencies. So in effect, it's discovery of the state agency's records and work product that was generated in connection with that.
Has the Attorney General already made that search, and were those the documents, have all those documents been searched for and tendered to the court, as you termed it?
We did not make the search. We objected to the scope of search and tendered affidavits to the court asserting those objections and stating that if the court required that the search be made, that a search would then be done. Preserving attorney-client privilege, et cetera.
Are the only documents then that were tendered, though not before us, those from your division?
From our division and from the divisions up the chain of command, or the sections up the chain of command relating to antitrust enforcement. So all antitrust enforcement-related documents of which we were aware were produced. And we are not aware of antitrust enforcement documents that would be in any other division. Although we do believe that some of the divisions, given the breadth of the request, might have documents that are responsive, even though they may be privileged.
Well, let me find out how my example is distinct. If you took a very large insurance company defendant that was operating all over the country and maybe all over the world, had divisions scattered out all here and yon, and a legal department that was quite sizable, and you requested information from them, and they said, well, we have these eight lawyers over here, and all they do is defend antitrust cases, and we're going to get them to respond, but we have securities lawyers, business lawyers, and regulation lawyers, and all these people, and we're not going to ask them what they know because we don't think we should have to. Now, why isn't that the same as the state's position in this case?
The distinction, Your Honor, is that the insurance company is the party in the example that you provided, and the party is required to turn over all responsive and otherwise producible documents in their possession. The outside counsel for that insurance company, who have other clients in the insurance industry and who may have information in their files that would be responsive to the request but are in no way related to that party, would not have to produce those responses. Similarly here, the state of Texas is the party, but I would submit that the state of Texas is the party in its antitrust enforcement capacity. It is not the party in its capacity as the Supreme Court. It is not the party in its capacity as the legislature. It is not the party in its capacity as the various boards, instrumentalities, and agencies of the state.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, ma'am. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Mr. Curtis, Ms. Beaver, is that argument for respondent?
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. Counsel. This is a suit by the state of Texas against several insurance companies in a suit under Section 1520 of the Antitrust Act for fines and for injunctive relief. This case has certainly got the attention of the real parties in interest, who I represent in this case, because they're asking for fines in this case in excess of $1 billion. They range from $10 million for the lowest fines that they're seeking to $200 million in fines that they are seeking against some of the other defendants. This case is one of the largest cases of its type known, certainly in the state of Texas and probably in the entire United States. It's a structural case where the state of Texas is trying to restructure the entire insurance industry in the United States and the implications that it would have in Lloyd's of London and the London market and throughout the world. It is certainly a massive case. This is a case where we need discovery because it is a structural case, because it is a case where they are seeking fines. This is not a case where the state is suing on behalf of, for instance, the highway department and saying there's a price-fixing conspiracy going on and we're trying to recover damages. This is not a case where the highway department, in that example, they have somebody there that we can go talk to, somebody we can say, well, how many miles of highway did you put out? How much did it cost? Where did you get the materials from? Who are the witnesses? This is a case where the state is relying on evidence that is obtained from third parties. This evidence was obtained by third parties or from third parties through the CID process in a pre-filing investigation. And we are, as we all know, here on a discovery dispute, which primarily centers on this CID issue. There are two issues that are not related to the CID issues here, and one is the complaint letters, and one has to do with the documents in the various divisions of the Attorney General's office. I'd like to pass over the latter two very quickly so that we can get down to what I think is the most important issue in this case, and that is the responsibilities of the state under the Civil Investigative Demand Statute. Let's talk about these citizen letters, which the state likes to call them. They're complaint letters. State thinks they should be private. Well, maybe they should be. Maybe they should be before this suit got started. But after the lawsuit got started, I can find no rationale for these letters to be made private. When the suit was filed in the petition, which you can find at Exhibit A, in the state's Exhibit A, on pages 7 and 8, the petition that was filed against my client and these others says that they were receiving 150 calls per day from the affected risk groups. Risk groups, what does that mean? That means insured, people who are insured. And we're not talking about mom and pop people. We're talking about commercial general liability insurance by businesses. So that's what they said in the petition. They were getting 150 calls per day. The petition referred to 18 different affected risk groups. It talked about clergy, ministers, daycare centers, pest control agencies, municipalities. That's who these letters are from.
Well, all right, we're talking about 9 letters, and more specifically, the identifying material on 9 letters first, aren't we?
Your Honor, we're talking about the identifying material on the 9 letters and on the letters that they have not been able to contact.
How many letters did you give?
Let me just finish this one inquiry. At those 9 letters, you have the letters. We're not talking about producing the letters. We're talking about producing the identity of the writers of those letters, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Did you have those letters at the time of the hearing?
They came after the hearing. At the hearing, what happened, I'm trying to remember, there were two different hearings here at different times, one in July, then another one in January, a motion for rehearing. We did not have them We got a set of them that were unredacted set. In other words, they said, okay, these are clean. They went and made all these telephone calls to all these folks,
right.
And then they gave us a set of them and said, okay, these are okay, we'll give these to you. The rest of them we're not going to give to you. At a later date, they gave them to us, but they deleted all identifying information, so you don't know whether it's a small business, a big business. You don't know whether what type of business they're in.
Did you have that at the time of the rehearing when Judge Lowry entered this final order? Do you have that information?
I do not recall, Your Honor.
What good cause did you show Judge Lowry that you should get the identity of the authors of those 9 letters?
There was no requirement of good cause. Good cause is being argued in this case with regard to the CID statute in particular, a particular paragraph that is in there. The citizen letters, the good cause that we showed was the fact that they are relevant to this case, that they were in the petition in this case, mentioned that the state was getting 150 calls per day.
You made an argument, which we have a transcript of, but other than that argument, you produced no evidence of any kind whatsoever, and Judge Lowry never looked at the letters. Is that right?
Judge Lowry never looked at the letters. That is correct as far as I know. I don't believe the letters
were
ever given to him. No, sir. I believe we do present evidence. We presented evidence on the fact that they were mentioned in the petition.
You argued, but you didn't present any evidence.
The petition was there, Your Honor, before the court. It's filed and before the court.
All right, so you directed the court's attention to the petition?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Other than that, is there anything that you contend was evidence as distinguished from argument of counsel?
I do not believe so.
And is that true with reference to the CID documents also, as far as satisfying any good cause showing that other than referring the court to the petition, you presented no evidence at any time?
That is not correct at all, Your Honor.
Okay. What evidence did you present?
First of all, we have contended, so we don't get off track here, we contended that good cause is not even necessary.
I understand.
What did we show as far as good cause to get the CID documents? We showed, we gave interrogatories, and we gave document requests. The interrogatories that we propounded were given to the court, and the document requests, so they knew exactly what it was that we were looking for. One of those things was, what evidence do you have that controverts the claims that are being made in this case? In the record were the state's responses to that. The responses were an absolute refusal to provide to us any of the CID deposition transcripts, an absolute refusal to provide any of the CID interrogatory answers from third parties, and a refusal to provide some of the CID documents. So that was there in the record before the court. Also before the court were the answers to the interrogatories, which the state said, I refuse to tell you who we sent the CID requests to. Also before the court is the fact of the unusual nature of this case. Now, what good cause do we have as a result of that? You have a good cause because of the unusual nature of this case with $1 billion in fines and the structural type that's going on. The allegations in the petition itself. We had at that time the state's request for an expedited trial. The state wanted to go to trial in about 9 months. That is good cause for getting this information and getting it right away. That was there and before the court. The state admitted at the hearing, and it was there before the court, that we're talking about events that go at least as far back as 1982, and witnesses were dying, they were retiring, they were leaving, their memories were dimming, and they were disappearing.
And I understand there were extensive arguments apparently at 2 hearings, but as far as evidence before the court to show good cause, the only thing that you say you presented were the pleadings and the discovery documents and the responses and objections to discovery documents. Is that right?
No, Your Honor.
As far as evidence.
I think I was saying that the state admitted at the hearing that these witnesses were in fact dying and disappearing and retiring and their memories were dimming. These were things that were before the court, including the request for an expedited trial. They were there. They were in the record.
And as far as whether any of that material that the state had in the CID request contained exculpatory remarks that would benefit your clients, Judge Lowry never made any determination of that, did he?
Judge Lowry never reviewed any of the CID deposition transcripts or any of the CID interrogatory responses, to my knowledge.
Until he does, how can we possibly know whether you're entitled to these documents?
I don't think we need to have him look at those documents to determine whether or not they are protected. The question is, under what privilege are they protected? We must first find a privilege somewhere. The state has always treated these in categories. They have never singled out a deposition and said, here is a deposition of all of these that we have taken that belongs to a true informant. Here is an interrogatory response or a set of interrogatory responses that is part of our investigative thing. Everything is treated as a category. That is the way it has been treated before Judge Lowry all the way along. Nothing has ever been singled out.
With regard to the CID materials and the CID statute that the state relies upon, assuming that a good cause requirement is in effect under that statute and that you're required to show good cause, isn't it essential that Judge Lowry conduct an in-camera inspection of those documents in order to determine whether there is any good cause to provide them?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the state has treated these in a category, in a group, the entire time. They have treated them as being protected by a single, just by a single category. They are claiming in this case, for instance, let's just take it a little at a time, that the CID depositions, the depositions that were taken of officials of a third-party insurance company of whom we have no knowledge, that makes him an informant. Now, do you need to look at a deposition transcript to find out whether that person who's been coerced to give testimony pursuant to the CID statute is an informant? I don't think so. They have never claimed that any one of these depositions is being was voluntarily given. Somebody who stepped forward and said, I'm a whistleblower and I want to tell about it. These are all coercive depositions that have been taken. Now, you don't need to look at a deposition or an interrogatory answer to tell whether that's an informant. They claim that that becomes a work product. It's covered by the work product privilege. When they ask a question during a deposition, the other side was present, the witness's lawyer was present, and they ask these questions and they got these answers and they say that that's work product. Now, do you need to read the contents of a deposition to determine whether that whole category of depositions would be covered by a work product rule? I don't think so. These are legal questions. They're not factual questions.
Well,
nothing
course,
in the contents.
Under the statute, they don't have to show any of that, do they, if the CID statute requires good cause before providing these? They don't have to show an informant privilege. They have a privilege under the statute, don't they? Isn't that one of the assertions of the state?
One of the assertions of the state is that we have to show good cause to be able to get the documents. In fact, they say that's the only way we can get it. And that is not correct.
Isn't one of the assertions of the state that if there were no informant or work product or the other privileges that you just described to me, that they would still be protected absent a showing of good cause under the CID statute, that that's a separate statutory privilege?
That's what they say.
All right. And why is there not a requirement on your part, given that statute, to show good cause in order to overcome that CID privilege as distinguished from the other ones that you just described here?
All right, John. We do not have to show good cause because the section of the Antitrust Act is a chapter, Chapter 15. It's broken up into two subchapters, Subchapter A, Subchapter B. Subchapter A is Sections 1 through 5, and has to do with the penalties and some definitions. Section 5 is the one they're suing them. Then it skips to Subchapter B. Subchapter B in the Act covers the procedures and evidence. It starts with Section 1510. That's the one they're talking about. That's the one they rely on. Our position is their reliance is misplaced. 1510 talks about the CID process. In the main, it talks about pre-filing, the pre-suit process. What they should be looking at, and what they've not brought to anybody's attention, and what they want to ignore, and what we argue to Judge Lowry is, you look at 1512. 1512 says, in addition to the procedures allowed in this subchapter, remember talking about subchapter B, and subchapter B has 1510, that's the one they're relying on. So it says, in addition to the ways you can go about it in 1510, the state and any party to a suit filed by the state can go through the normal process of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. That's where your authority comes in for the defendants to be able to get these documents. That is the post-suit, once a suit has been filed. The observation that you made earlier is correct with regard to the antitrust statute of the federal government. these documents would clearly be required under the federal statute of the Antitrust Civil Process Act.
Let me pause there for just a minute as to the 1512, 1510 argument. If we don't accept your argument on 1512, then you lose.
No, Your Honor. Got another one.
Okay, give me the next one.
1510I1 is what they rely on. That's where it says good cause. But it says two things. It says, except as ordered by this court for good cause shown, or as provided in this section. What section? Section 1510. So there's two ways, right off the bat, under section 1510I, the one they rely on. All right. You don't ever have to get to the good cause argument. In fact, that is irrelevant. We say 1512. Now, how do you get the other way? Well, what other way is provided in this statute? Well, they say the only other way is to go to 1510I2, where you go to this may, as the Attorney General may determine language. We would suggest, Your Honor, that the language of that particular statute or that particular subsection really, again, refers to pre-suit activities. When can the Attorney General give it up, and how should he give it up? Now, why do I say it refers to pre-suit activities? Because it refers to the investigation or a, quote, judicial proceeding. There are several judicial proceedings that can occur during the investigative stage when people contest what's going on. The statute refers to judicial proceedings there, and in other sections it refers to suits. So I think that their reliance is entirely misplaced. Where should they place their reliance? Because, remember, 1510 said any way provided by this section, section 1510. Well, let's go to 1510I3. 1510I3, remember, we're not talking about good cause. We still haven't gotten to that yet. We're taking a different route. 1510I3 is modeled on and after the Antitrust Civil Process Act. That is where you get there. The language is almost identical when you look at it. What are the differences? They talk about under I2, the one they rely on, as he determines may be required by the state. Well, that's what we're here to talk about today, is what does that phrase mean, as may be required by the state? Well, does it appear any other place in the statute? Yes, it does. It appears under I3, the one I'd say that we have to go to. And it says the same thing, as he determines may be required by. And then it talks about an officer of the court. That is the same language that is in the Antitrust Civil Process Act. Just trying to find the exact language in the process. So here it is. The Antitrust Civil Process Act, in its comparable statute, says, as such attorney determines to be required. Now, that's not anything different than as the Attorney General determines may be required by.
What section is that of the Federal Civil Process Act?
1331D1.
Thank you.
It is no different, really, than what they say in Massachusetts, really, and we've shown you that the states, the other states, the few cases that are reported on this subject have the same type of language. Massachusetts, like Texas, says, let's look to comparable federal statutes to guide us when we have a question. That's the same thing Texas does. Massachusetts has the same thing. The Massachusetts language is except as necessary, as contrasted with our language in Texas, as he determines may be required by. There is no difference in these. There are several different ways to get to these documents. We say go to 1512. If you don't go there, then follow 1510I, which says as may be provided in this section, and then you go to 1510I3. That's where you go because that is the part that is modeled after the Antitrust Civil Process Act. You don't ever have to get to, under any of this reasoning, get to the good cause shown. To get to the good cause shown, I think you, if you go to even using their argument under 1510 section 2, I2, the real question is, what does as may be determined mean? We say it means as may be determined by the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. That is the boundary. That's what we're talking about. That's the standard That's the standard by which they got the documents. The CID statute says you've got to use.
If you accept that argument, then really why is there any reason to have the rest of the subsection 1 at all? Why
because,
have a
Your
restriction
Honor,
to the CID? Why have a CID statutory privilege if you can completely circumvent it?
Because, Your Honor, I think the public policy of this state that is implicated here and is important and was discussed widely at the time this bill was being debated was there's a coercive process through the CID statute. You go out and you force people to give you documents under fines and penalties. You force them to give you testimony and interrogatory answers. They've got to give them. The statute protects that information while it is in the investigative stage. I think the statistics in the legislative history of the federal statute show that 75% of those investigations are concluded without a suit ever being brought. So what we are trying to protect is during the investigative stage, this business information that is sensitive and confidential and it will not be spread all over the streets. But once a suit is filed, and that's where the distinction comes in, once the suit is filed, that confidentiality disappears, and it must, it absolutely must, because the state must rely on the information it gained from third parties to prosecute this type of a suit for fines and penalties. And that time, we must have the right to confront our accusers and be able to prepare our defense.
Regards to citizen letters, is there any relevance at this point to those letters other than to impeach the state's assertion of how many complaints they were getting and who they were from?
The citizen letters are from people who had different types of insurance. They are not only citizen letters or complaint letters from people who had general liability insurance, they are from doctors and other professionals in there. Doctors and other professionals do not, as a general rule, are not concerned about general liability insurance. All right, what relevance does that have to us? In this case, there is the allegation that what we did was we put pressure, the insurance companies went out and put pressure in tort reform efforts on doctors and professionals, insurance agents. There are letters in there from insurance agents. On their errors and omissions policies, directors and officers' liability policies, these type of things. So that's what some of these letters are on. These are allegedly, we assume, the people that complained about the pressure being put on them as a part of the tort reform movement, which was a way to, under this theory of the state, to get down to a boycott on the general liability side. So yes, potentially there are. These people are potential witnesses in this case.
How many letters did you receive?
I'm going to say around 200.
And so there's 85 that are in dispute.
I'm correct, Your Honor. That's pretty close.
And what other types, very briefly, what other types of discovery have you received from the state that's not an issue here?
Okay. We have received from the state certain selected documents that they have chosen to give to us that they obtained during the CID process. Documents. What are we talking about? We are talking about documents from Company A to Company B that the state picked up. They're evidence. They weren't made for this case or for the CID. These are documents going back in history. They have withheld selectively some. We don't really know why.
Are you making it? You're not making any waiver argument to this court, are you? That choice is by the choices that the state has made, they waive their rights to.
Their position is certainly inconsistent. We have not specifically argued waiver, but the same statutes which cover good cause, which cover may be required, the very same statutes treat all of these categories of documents the same. Talk about documentary material, evidence, third-party type stuff. They talk about the interrogatories, and they talk about the deposition.
But essentially, the information you have received from the state has been gathered by the state in the CID process.
Yes, Your Honor. They are only a portion of the documents which Texas or some of the other states picked up during their CID processes. A portion of that has been given to us. The remainder, no depositions except for our own, the ones that belong to our own people. and no transcripts. The document that we filed this morning, Your Honor, shows that last week and a half, we picked up some of these CIDs during depositions, two in Houston and one in Illinois. And what they show you is we stumbled upon these. We didn't know that they had these CID interrogatory responses, and they have exculpatory evidence in these documents. They are statements that hurt the case of the state of Texas. They show that these people were never even in the business of insuring municipalities, and they were when Westlake Hills.
That's all included in this handout.
That is. I've not even read the thing, Your Honor. I know generally what's in there that was filed today by another co-defendant in the case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I would like to respond first to several of the questions that were asked of the parties in interest counsel. As to what was produced from the state's file to the defendants of the Texas CID documents, over 20 boxes of documents were produced out of a total of 27 boxes of files. The 27 included all of the CID statements and interrogatories, which were later broken down into other boxes. It doesn't show very clearly in the record, but Mr. White, when he argued, pointed to the court that we were talking about a segment of documents, a large file folder wide in terms of the number of documents that were held pursuant to Texas civil investigative demands. There was a slightly larger quantity of documents that were withheld pursuant to other state civil investigative demands, which are not before this court because the court has not ruled on the assertions of privilege by the other states. However, nearly all of the documents obtained by those other states were also produced by the state of Texas to the defendants because the state of Texas intended to use them or thought it might use them at trial. Which brings me to the three sections now that are being discussed under 1510. The section 2, subsection 2 of I, which defendants argue has no discretion in it, says the Attorney General may make available civil investigative demand materials in his or her possession as he or she determines may be required by the state in the course of any investigation or judicial proceeding in which the state is a party. We submit that that does imply discretion, and that is the discretion that we asserted. As to documents, the documents we did not provide were documents we viewed as irrelevant to the case we ultimately filed. We did not assert an irrelevancy objection as to the CID statements nor interrogatories. We did as to that small portion of documents which we did not provide. Subsection 3, which the defendants now raise as another position in support of their argument that good cause is not required, states that the Attorney General may make available CID material in his or her possession as he or she determines may be required for official use by any officer of the state of Texas or the United States charged with the enforcement of the laws of the state of Texas or the United States. And, in fact, this provision is ordinarily used for what's called information sharing with federal antitrust officials when they provide the requisite assurances of confidentiality. The defendants misconceive the use of the civil investigative demand in the sense that they continue to assert its coercive nature. Yes, response is mandatory, but it is also an important tool to obtain information. We frequently have attorneys tell us, yes, our client will cooperate, but you must first issue us a civil investigative demand. That is not to say, then, that the witness appears in a coercive or adversarial posture. That argument simply does not conceive of the practicality of use. Sometimes it is indeed coercive. It is not always. The state did not admit that any CID recipients were unavailable. There's an extrapolation of the argument. The defendants have taken the argument that we made in support of our assertions that the case should go to trial because the matters at issue were rapidly history, and have extrapolated that to say that we have admitted that some of the CID recipients are now traditionally unavailable. There's been no such showing, and in fact, I do not know that's the case. The 1512 argument that the defendants have made does not abrogate good cause. 1512, in its reference to the rules of civil procedure, is necessary because pre-filing discovery under 1510 is just that. Once a case is filed, the state may not use its CID powers in that proceeding, and any discovery it is going to proceed with would have to occur under the regular rules of civil procedure.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will take another brief recess.
Got it.